So, Bruce, this was a different time for air travel in Illinois. Air Illinois was among these commuter air services serving a lot of different smaller communities.
Oh, yeah. There was air service, regular air service to communities as small as Mount Vernon. There was regular air service between Decatur and Springfield, $5 each way in case you didn't want to drive. There were airlines as, running regular flights as small as Beechcrafts, which are very small civil airplanes with room for just five people in them. And these weren't they were a combination somewhat of air taxis. That's what some folks would consider them to be. But this was considered to be a burgeoning industry in central and southern throughout Illinois. And there were predictions in 1974. There was a study done for the Capital Airport that predicted by 2005, looking forward into the future, if we extrapolate the increases in passenger traffic that we've seen in recent years, it arrives at 1.6 million people going through that airport per year in 2005. We've gotten nowhere close to that. I think last year there was something south of 200,000 that went through the airport in Springfield. But there were high expectations. The Daily Newspaper had a regular aviation column. It was published every Sunday right next to Ann Landers that was devoted exclusively to aviation in Springfield. It's a different time for newspapers and different time for aviation.
Well, let's go back to this crash, Flight 710, Air Illinois. Set the scene for us. This flight took off from Springfield. It's the fateful flight here that evening, and immediately, or pretty quickly, there was a problem detected.
Yeah, what happened was the flight had frankly, it originated in Meigs Field in Chicago. It made the flight from Chicago to here in Springfield. I can't remember how many passengers disembarked in Springfield. There were seven aboard when the plane took off from Springfield. It was approximately 40, 45 minutes late. It was 20 minutes after 8 p.m. or so, mid-October. The weather was good here. It was deteriorating further south. There were some thunderstorms reported in the area. But that the weather wasn't really the issue. The issue was twofold. One, you had a mechanical issue. This plane had been having difficulty with its generator system, primarily the right generator. And the way you have to think about this aircraft was a 44-seater, has two generators that power the entire electrical system of the airplane. Everything from the instruments in the cockpits to the lights in the bathroom to the navigation lights outside. And the plane could fly and well, apparently, if just on just one generator. If both generators went out, then you were down to battery power. And the batteries in the plane were designed and could last for a minimum of 30 minutes. They had 30 minutes where they could have stayed aloft. After that, the electricity would have gone out. They would have had no instruments. They would have been in some fairly severe problems, particularly if they needed instruments to fly. The plane experienced a generator malfunction almost immediately upon takeoff from Springfield. And the first officer, i.e. the co-pilot of the plane, figured, oh, it's the right generator again. And so the first thing you're supposed to do if you have a generator issue in this aircraft is that you're supposed to isolate the faulty generator from the rest of the electrical system. So he isolated the right generator from the electrical system. The right generator was fine. The left generator was broken. And so, boom, he has no power from the generators. And so he quickly realizes, you know, what the issue is and tries to reconnect the right generator. Can't do it. Even though it's functioning, it's essentially of no help whatsoever because it's not providing any power to the plane. Within 5 minutes of the Springfield Airport, when they realize we don't have any generator power. And the pilot, Lester Smith, said, well, let's keep going south. And it's my understanding they passed, I thought I saw one reference, they passed something like nine airports on this last journey before they finally came down in a pasture.
And they were headed toward Carbondale?
They were going to Carbondale. It was a 40-minute flight from, a scheduled 40-minute flight from Springfield to Carbondale. So they have a minimum of 30 minutes on battery power. They know that it's going to take 40 minutes. They might make it. The batteries might last. Batteries might not last. The co-pilot is, as you could imagine, is keeping a close eye on the voltage levels in the batteries. He wants to make sure that they've got enough juice. And they're flying along, and they look to be okay. You know, they're at 20, plus amps, and that's an electrical term, but it means that there's voltage, and 20 plus amps is considered to be, you're doing okay. What he didn't know was these were nickel-cadmium batteries as opposed to lead-based batteries. And nickel-cadmium batteries, they'll look fine until they're almost out of juice. And once they start showing any signs of depletion, they're going to go from 20 amps to zero very, very, very quickly.
This plane crashed in a farm field in Perry County, Pinckneyville.
Just outside Pinckneyville, yes.
And no one survived.
Nobody survived.
Eventually, pilot error was the determining factor. And basically, what the FAA said was the pilot should have turned back and gone to Springfield and landed when he noticed the problem.
Absolutely, he should have turned around. And it didn't really take an Einstein to figure that out. If you know that anything past 30 minutes on a battery is premium time, you're on borrowed time, and you're 40 minutes away from your destination, why he didn't turn around? Very, very good question. After the tragedy, as part of the investigation, the FAA interviewed, as a matter of course, fellow pilots and those who were familiar with Mr. Smith and his habits. He had a propensity to cut corners and to take chances to stay on schedule, and he was 40 minutes behind schedule this night. Plus, he lived in Carbondale. The assumption, the conclusion of investigators was he had a known history of trying to do things to stay on schedule, including he would fly under thunderstorms or very close to them rather than giving them wide berth. The wise course of manner is there's bad weather there. I'm going to take a little bit longer to get to my destination to avoid this thunderstorms. He'd go right up to the edge of them. When he was landing at Meigs Field and other places, he would exceed the maximum allowable speed for the aircraft. His shortfalls were well known within the staff of Air Illinois. In fact, one pilot told the FAA the National Transportation Safety Board investigators after the fact that she had asked the co-pilot, how can you just sit there and let him do these things? And he answered, well, I always keep a close eye on things, and I never let him get into a situation that I don't think we can recover from. Which is another mystery. All of my reporting, or a great deal of it, was based on the cockpit voice recorder. There was never at any point where the co-pilot said, Mr. Smith, we need to turn around, and we need to turn around now. On the ground controller, shortly after takeoff, the pilot said, I have an unusual request, we'd like to go down to 2,000 feet. Well, this plane is supposed to normally fly at 10,000 feet. And he'd also said, we have a slight electrical problem. Well, they didn't have a slight electrical problem. They had a major electrical problem. And so the controller said, I can't take you down to 2,000 feet because at that point you disappear from radar. So I'll let you go to 3,000 feet. That's what happened. At one point in time, a flight attendant came forward from the cabin and asked about, why is it dark back there? People are asking questions. And the pilot said, Mr. Smith said, well, we have an electrical problem, but we're going to continue to Carbondale, and we have to conserve electricity. And I tried to put myself in the place of one of those passengers. It's dark. The lights aren't working. Wouldn't you be a little concerned? Man, I mean, the flight lasted, I think, didn't last 35 minutes. I think it lasted about 32. They came down 40 miles north of Carbondale, and they were headed northeast when they hit the ground, northwest when they hit the ground. So they were going in the wrong direction and fairly well short of their destination when they ran out of power.
We're talking with Bruce Rushton. He's a staff writer for the Illinois Times. He wrote about Flight 710 Air Illinois. This crashed back in the early 80s in southern Illinois. And Bruce, a lot more came out about Air Illinois, it seemed to, after this crash occurred. There were some shady things going on in the whole operation. Mm-hmm. The crash also served as a national wake-up call, I think, for this type of air travel, these cheaper airlines, smaller airlines, mm-hmm. and some of the things that were going on there. Talk about that as well.
It was somewhat a question of timing, let's put it that way. Remember, this is in October 1983. This is right after PATCO, the air traffic controllers, had gone on strike. It was an illegal strike, and Reagan had fired all the air traffic controllers. So Reagan was getting quite a bit of credit for it, not the least of which there were predictions at the time by folks, including the air traffic controllers, were absolutely vital to the air transportation system. If we go off the job, planes are going to be crashing and people are going to die. That didn't happen with regard to the air traffic controllers. But with a lot less attention, what Reagan had also done is dramatically reduced the number of inspectors assigned to watch over all the airlines in the United States, not just the small ones. And it was something, I believe, like a 7% cut. And so when Air Illinois went down, for that was part of the Reagan, of course, as all politicians do, have his political enemies. And you had Paul Simon, who was then U.S. representative, soon to be elected to the Senate, was helping lead the charge, saying, this is what happens when you reduce the number of regulators. Elizabeth Dole, shortly after this crash, announced on Meet the Press, she announced that they were going to increase the number of FAA inspectors back to 1981 levels. And within a number of months, they hired, I believe, 166 inspectors to watch over all the airlines. And they needed to, because in this particular case, one of the inspectors that was in charge with making sure the avionics, which are the electrical instruments on an airplane, he was supposed to be inspecting those. Well, he'd had knee surgery. So he hadn't made it down to Air Illinois in a while, but no issues. Another person was supposed to have done that. And that person said, I don't know anything about avionics. I'm not qualified to do this. The way that it was termed in the crash report was that the inspections were, quote, less aggressive than they should have been. It turned out mechanics were falsifying records. Parts are supposed to be inspected on a regular basis. But it was easier to inspect the parts sooner, some of these parts, sooner than they were supposed to be inspected while they had everything apart. So they'd do it then and then post-date the records to make it look like the parts had been inspected on a regular basis as they were supposed to have been done. There were records that were hidden from the FAA. It was crystal clear in the report. The investigators did, I think, probably the obvious thing. They blamed the pilot. It was pilot error. He should have turned around. But they also said there are these other issues that need to be addressed. And they were addressed in some form or fashion, at least by the hiring of more inspectors.
So that was somewhat the legacy of the Air Illinois Flight 710. But also it seems to me that some of the legacy was the decline of this type of air travel. It seemed as though maybe people, like you said, I can, instead of driving or trying to get there in some other way, I can take a quick flight pretty cheap to get someplace. People might have thought twice about that.
They may have thought twice about it. I mean, I know I kind of think a little bit when I get in a plane when I can't stand upright. That's kind of a little, and that's still in the back of, I think, of people's minds. Am I on Wright Brothers Airlines here or what is it? But I think it's more than that. It came out after the crash, that Air Illinois had never been profitable. I mean, it had been flying for 14 years. They had some financial issues. It wasn't a particularly healthy business. And after the crash, they were going to be bought out by, I believe, Midwest Airlines. The airline quit flying for a month. It resumed on a limited basis. There was talk of it being bought out. Midwest Airlines was one of the larger airlines then in existence outside of the Deltas and the Uniteds of the world. And they backed out of it. And I'm not sure that it was because people were just afraid to fly. It's just the economics of it. You can't fly from Mount Vernon to Decatur to Timbuktu with four people on a 50, or 20-seat plane and make money at it. It just doesn't seem like it's possible. There had been a prior crash in 1971 that didn't get the same amount of attention, but it certainly helped Air Illinois establish itself as one of the dominant smaller airlines in the state. And that was a crash that happened at the Peoria Airport, Chicago and Southern. The gentleman who was flying the plane was also the president of the airline, and if that's not potentially problematic, and it was noted as potentially problematic after the fact, he was trying to land in dense fog. There had been two planes, Ozark Airlines, that had made a combined five approaches and aborted each one, then landed elsewhere. Couldn't see where he was going, dense fog. And he tried it anyway, ended up in power lines. The plane turned into a fireball. All 16 aboard crashed. And it turned out after the fact the airline was so strapped that it couldn't buy fuel in Chicago or Springfield. They wouldn't sell it to him on credit. He'd been cited numerous times by regulators for such things as flying with instruments despite not having passed a proficiency check. Pilots had routinely apparently exceeded the amount of time they were supposed to be on duty. They were popping no-dos and diet pills to stay awake. And so this is not the sort of industry that we know and expect today. At least I certainly hope that if I go into a cockpit today, we're not seeing and hearing these sorts of conversations. And so people are afraid to get into smaller airplanes, but it's also a question of economics. And I think a lot of the planes of these smaller commuter airlines, the smaller airlines still, of course, exist, but oftentimes they're feeders to the larger ones. They have contracts with the Americans of the world, for lack, just to pull a name out of the air, so that they will bring folks from smaller communities such as Springfield into the airports where they can make connections in St. Louis or Chicago or where have you. But back then, there was just an expectation that, oh, well, airplanes are a wave of the future, and why drive when you can fly?